Hello and welcome to What Comes Next, a show about the mind-blowing technologies that will shape your future. I'm Kwaku Akinmensah.
I'm Amy Dickens.
And I'm Rob Cup.
Hey, Amy, Rob, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing really well, thanks. Really well. Just got back from the US, which was a lovely trip, went for Thanksgiving, had an absolutely lovely time. I was hoping when I came back to the UK, I'd be coming to a kind of a more tepid winter. But it's absolutely bone freezing today. I think it was a couple of degrees below freezing, or about that, and it was just been absolutely frigid. So quite romantic weather at the same time. So I don't mind it, but yeah, pretty cold.
There's nothing romantic about sweatpants and hot water bottles. But
if you add candles, Amy, if you add candles, then it can be anything can be romantic.
I'm doing good as well. I'm actually on the opposite side. So I'm over on the west coast of Canada, which today is beautiful and mild and sunny and quite warm by winter standards. But we've just come off the tail end of like atmospheric rivers and horrific apocalyptic rains. So
did you say atmospheric rivers, Amy? Right. You're going to need to give me at least a sort of, you know, a 3-second breakdown.
Basically, like mass flooding of rivers, like extensive flooding of rivers, right? I don't know what the I'm sure like a meteorologist would have a much better description of what an atmospheric river is. But yeah, basically we've got the Coquihalla Highway, which is one of the main highways through BC through the mountains, in sections has just like completely slid down the mountain because of the rains. Like the actual highway has slid down the mountain.
Oh my God.
So yeah, we've just got like holes in our highway now, and obviously it's unusable. People can't use it. So we're dealing with that. And yeah, Canada's in a great state. So bring on climate change.
Whoa. Yeah, that's pretty serious. It makes our very cold England that does seem quite tepid in the
it's one of these it's one of these things that's really relative, right? Because yeah, sitting in England when it's a bit cold, you sort of think, okay, well, in Canada they're losing a highway, but then in Canada we're still in a better position than other parts of the world that are suffering much worse from climate change. So
sure.
Yeah, you know, it's just I mean, I think we all know that it's a disaster that needs to be fixed. But anyway, happy thoughts. Moving on.
Happy thoughts, yeah. Now, yeah, how are you, Kwaku, with those happy thoughts in mind?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Just been like busy as anything with work at the moment, which has been good. Speaking to some absolutely awesome companies and a few who are working in the carbon offsetting space, which is like a whole interesting field that I'm trying to get my head around. So that's been kind of cool. Hopefully helping some of those guys get access to some government funding. So that's cool. And aside from that, I've been delving into this book. Actually, our CEO recommended this book to me ages ago. Have you guys heard of a book called Gut?
Yes.
I have not only heard of it, I have read it.
Oh my God, it's amazing. It's
Julia Enders, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I loved it. I actually recommended it to my dad recently because I found it super interesting to understand the connection between the sort of brain and the second brain, which is the gut. And I'm definitely one of these people, and so is my dad, who like stress lives in my gut. If I'm stressed out, I get horrendous issues with, you know, stomach aches and all that kind of stuff, and indigestion and just crazy things. So yeah, I read it because I thought it would be really interesting to start understanding how all of that is related and how it's, you know, it's an incredible organ. And it's so interesting how you start to read. I haven't read it in a while, so I can't remember the details. You might be more up to date with this, but even like the certain types of bacteria can affect the way you think about things.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Yeah. It's literally like in conversation with your brain.
It's absolutely stuff. Phenomenal. And you know, the writing style is brilliant as well. Really accessible, obviously,
really accessible.
By somebody who absolutely loves the subject matter. And then, you know, every now and then you'll just get like an absolute gem like you know, the gut flattened out would be 80 kilometers long, something crazy mm-hmm. like that. You know, they just drop these gems in there. So yeah, I'm really, really enjoying that. I think I'm about a third of the way into it, but yeah, like buzzing about that one. I love a geek out book, so that's good. But alas, today we're not here to talk about gut feelings. We are here to talk about the incredible topic of time. That's because today we're speaking with Richard Hoptroff, the founder and CEO of Hoptroff, a company delivering traceable time as a service. In this interview, we discuss how all days are not equal in length, the evolution of timekeeping, and the efforts that Hoptroff is making to ensure that crucial timekeeping and traceability is accurate in a world moving at hyperspeed. Without further ado, this is what comes next. Richard, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
Pleased to meet you.
Yeah, really, really good to meet you. And so I met a couple of your colleagues from Hoptroff. Maybe by way of a kind of initial introduction, could you tell us what Hoptroff does?
Well, very simply, it tells people what the time is. Or to be more precise, it tells computers what the time is to levels of accuracy of up to 1 millionth of a second.
1 millionth of a second. Okay. And to give our listeners some kind of context, what would be a regular degree of accuracy that you might see in day-to-day life?
Well, in day-to-day life for you and me is probably making that Zoom call on time. So on a human scale, right now, you know, a Zoom call is maybe a minute accuracy. If you're navigating at sea, you probably, as Harrison made happen, you probably need that kind of accuracy as well. But as the world speeds up, and particularly as it becomes more and more virtual and electronic, that need for accuracy increases to a greater an extent. For all sorts of reasons, computers need to keep a record of what happens and know how to work with each other to a thousandth of a second in some cases, a millionth of a second in others. And without that kind of synchronization, our virtual world just falls apart.
Mm. Okay. I mean, just from the initial outset here, I mean, it sounds like your target market is anybody who deals with time on a regular basis. How do you even approach a market like that?
Well, you focus on the people who need it most, I guess. So, for example, I think it was May the 10th or May the 6th, 2010, at 3:15 in the afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time, a bunch of automated trading robots at the New York Stock Exchange just got into this vicious cycle and traded crazily. To the point the whole market went mad, and the share price of Accenture went to 1 cent. And for a glorious moment, Hewlett Packard had a market capitalization of $114 trillion. now, actually, as suddenly as it happened, it all went back to normal about half an hour later. But the problem was when they tried to work out what had happened, they realized that these trading robots, their clocks weren't set particularly accurately at all. So you couldn't work out the sequence of events that happened. And that's still true to this day, that we don't know what happened. As a result of that, the MiFID II and Consolidated Audit Trail regulations came into force in 2018. And now we're much more able to sequence events. In automated trading perspectives, that's right down to a millionth of a second in some respects. So it's in financial markets, it's a regulatory requirement. And the reason they need time, in their case, is to establish the sequence of events, so causality. But that's just one aspect of why you might need time synchronization. But that's obvious low-hanging fruit for us to pick off, because obviously the banks were obliged to actually provide time synchronization to this level.
I mean, it sounds like the world has kind of been on a collision course with an accuracy of timing for a very long time now, and technology is kind of catching up to the kind of waking up to that problem.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, it's nothing new. Back in, as I mentioned, Harrison before, as people travelled for longer distances, they needed to know the time to know where they are. As railways were introduced, we couldn't just use the local noon to work out when to catch a train. So that's when the idea of time zones got introduced. The fact that we would have a universal time standard and then different time zones around the world. You know, before that, you know, Bristol was 10 minutes behind London. You know, but now it's not. That natural progression is just continuing as the world gets faster. I mean, we're not getting faster, but the computers we use are. And so that's the progression, but we still have to have time being measured as accurately as the decisions that get made, or more accurately, in order for them to function properly.
You speak in a manner that suggests you have spent a reasonable amount of time thinking about this problem, and it sounds very, very complex. How does somebody get into the field that you're in? Can you tell me a little bit about your background and what's brought you to the place you are today?
Well, my background is that I'm a physicist specializing in, at the time it was called neural networks, but you'd now know it as machine learning. So a lot of what I was doing was analysis of time series data, things like that, and applying artificial intelligence to that. And after my PhD, I started a neural network forecasting company, which businesses used our software to actually forecast future things, like how many sandwiches to put on the shelf, simple as that, to actually analyzing businesses to see, you know, what would the impact if I changed my price, you know, what return am I getting on advertising and so on. But that sort of time series, I was very much looking at time as a way to predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I went to Oxford University to the archaeology department there, and actually worked with them, because I also did optics in my PhD, on actually dating the age of buildings, because I won't go into the details, but as quartz gets cut away from light, for example, you put a brick on top of another brick, it slowly builds up a charge, and you can measure that charge and therefore estimate the age of the building.
Well, the length of time that it's been
binned up.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
I did work there on, you know, a lot of work in Jerusalem, Cairo pyramids and stuff. And then decided to get back into business again.
A little hiatus.
But a fun one. But, you know, I've done a business which focused on predicting the future.
My goodness.
Looking at dating the past.
Cool.
And quite by accident, I got back into it by looking at the present. The way this happened was I had started a Bluetooth company making Bluetooth radios. And at the time, my wife's cousin started getting well-known, Kim Jones, started getting quite well-known in the fashion industry. So I got exposed to a lot of the fashion industry. I thought, oh, this is interesting, you know, to actually see fashion industry as an industry, not as this glamorous thing that you see from the outside.
Mm.
I thought, well, this would be fun to do something like this. And I thought, well, the only thing I could probably do, because I'm not artistically creative, is a watch company. So I actually used the Bluetooth chips, combined them with tiny little motors to make an analog watch that was Bluetooth connected. And this was before Apple watches and things like this, but they looked like proper luxury timepieces. And I tried doing things like connecting them to my phone so that you could have things like a share price coming up on a dial, a live share price, or football results or something like that. And then it became increasingly apparent that the thing that people really were interested in was the most accurate timepieces. Mm. So at the time, the most accurate timepieces were by Seiko. They were accurate to 3 seconds every year. So I set myself the challenge of doing one that was accurate to 1 second a year. We achieved that, but in order to achieve that, we needed a very, very accurate time source. So I searched around for an atomic clock and looked on eBay and so on.
Where do you search for an atomic clock? What's the quite a small pool of places you have to check?
Just Facebook Marketplace, atomic clock.
Eventually, I came across what was called a chip scale atomic clock, which is used by the US military in their cruise missiles. And I contacted them and said, would you sell me one, please? they had a little matchbox, those things. And to my surprise, they said yes. And so I bought some of those and I started using them to calibrate these watches. Mm. And it was only after about 3 months of doing this that it actually crossed my mind to put the atomic clock itself inside a timepiece. So we actually then made the first luxury atomic timepieces, and they're accurate to 1 second every 1,000 years.
Wow, okay.
Wow.
And if you think about it, over history, there's not been many timekeeping mechanisms. There's been Virgin Folio, there's been a pendulum, there's been a balance spring, there's been quartz, and I've done atomic. You know, so it's actually probably, if I get remembered for anything, it'll be that, I should imagine. But anyway, what happened was, as this business was developing and I was discovering how horrific B2C is compared to B2B, I thought, well, maybe this isn't for me. And at that time, some of my friends who happened to work in financial services started asking me about how to synchronize servers in data centers to very, very high accuracies. And so I saw the chance to pivot. And I set up the new business with the partners we have today.
Mm.
And that had the very initial goal of providing timing for financial services because it was a regulatory requirement. And from there, it has started to blossom because we're acutely aware of the need for accurate timing in many, many spheres for different reasons, not just the causality that I mentioned, but looking for patterns in data and actually synchronizing things so that they can interoperate, particularly if you've got something like vehicles at a junction or trucks traveling in a convoy, something like that. The synchronization between them has to be very, very tight. And that is quite difficult to achieve. So it's a very pleasant challenge to be faced with. And that's what we're working on now. To get everybody's clocks to agree is remarkably difficult. Most people think, well, it's a computer, it should be able to work it out. But actually, time is a physical quantity. It's not something that you can just work out on the back of a sheet of paper. It has to be somehow pumped into the system from an external source, and it has to be done in such a way that everybody's watches, clocks agree.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge. And it's actually working out how to do that at massive scale and low cost is the challenge we're setting ourselves today. And being able to ensure that we can do that with billions of devices. Many of those initially will still be servers in data centers, but it will have to go right down to the Internet of Things, everything from the autonomous vehicles I mentioned to sensors. One project we're working on at the moment is related to the sensors for detecting drones around airfields, because right. they're dotted around the airfield. When all the data comes back, you need to make sure that the signals can be resynchronized. Otherwise, you can't actually work out where that drone is coming from. So applications such as this, and right down to, just like a parking meter or a congestion charging camera, it will create evidence of your behavior. But if its clock isn't correct, you may be treated unfairly. So being able to prove that that clock is correct is very important. So this is moving way beyond computers to an entire smart city of virtual devices.
Is it fair to say that you have two problems at the same time when thinking about this level of synchronicity? The first part is the accuracy of the clock, and the second part is the idea that time isn't finite, it's relative, and that you have to deal with relativistic effects. I know that obviously satellites have this problem that you need to adjust for relativity in order to create an accurate global positioning system. So is that as a physicist something
I was definitely going to ask if you've inadvertently been involved in proving the theory of relativity at all.
Relativity itself is such a small effect that it doesn't matter at the timescales we care about.
Okay.
That's at the nanoseconds timescale, which is a billionth of a second, whereas the timescales that computers operate at, well, it's no more than 10 millionths of a second. So that in itself hasn't become important. But relativeness, if you like, is important. You know, for the clocks to agree, there has to be an absolute. Mm. Yeah, relative time is fine as far as if you can just reference one clock, that's fine. But a lot of these distributed systems require different clocks to be producing the timestamps. And you might be taking the difference between those clocks to get a time interval. Mm. And that's going to be meaningless data unless the clocks agree. So what we have is what's called a universal standard called UTC. So we connect to scientific institutions and distribute that both over satellite using the GPS, GLONASS and so on. But we also have terrestrial connections as well. So we are terrestrially connected to these scientific institutions. The reason for that is that the satellite systems themselves can no longer be treated as reliable for navigation or timing in critical national infrastructure. The signals are so weak and so prone to being attacked, particularly in conflict areas, that there has to be some kind of alternative. And this, in this respect, the US signed an executive order last year saying that all timekeeping in critical national infrastructure, everything from telecoms, power generation, broadcast and so on, had to have an alternative to satellite distribution over time. Mm. So we're very much getting into the terrestrial distribution of time and actually working out how to do it completely over internet protocol. And we can, you know, these days we can reach pretty much anywhere on the planet except Antarctica, and that's about it.
Wow. I think it's probably worth, I know we've touched on it and talked about the different sort of fields in which kind of accurate timekeeping at this level is useful, but can you give us a sense of kind of what is at stake when thinking about synchronicity between devices? You know, let's say if you know within a network of devices, those devices become out of sync. What could happen? You know, how much of sort of our digital lives is currently dependent on synchronicity, and how fragile is that?
Well, there are a number of different aspects to why people want accurate time. I mean, the one I just touched on with the parking meter is where justice would not be done if the time is wrong. So, you know, most of the time it wouldn't matter about the parking meter, but there may be times when it would, and it might be some very important evidence. For example, it's a requirement for 911 calls to be what we call traceably recorded. So they have to be, the time when these things happened has to be definitely correct because, obviously because lives are at stake, but also we have to work out whether that was genuinely executed or whether the data is wrong.
Of course, because if you're going to admit a call as a piece of evidence in court for like a murder trial, then you need to know 100% that it occurred at a certain time. Otherwise, it's going to be inadmissible, right?
That's right. And exactly how long did it take the ambulance to get there? And so on.
Or even things like, I imagine, like getting on a transplant list or something when there's, you know, thousands of people who are being put on a list at the same time for like one kidney. And it's like fractions of seconds to see who's actually at the top of the list.
Yes, indeed. I mean, in terms of the sort of sector where accurate timing is needed, it's often for things like frequency generation. Right. So you transmit at the right frequency. So obviously, if you transmit at the wrong frequency, not only will nobody hear you, but you'll probably be stamping on somebody else's frequency footprint. Between computers, things like synchronous Ethernet, to maximize the use of bandwidth, you need to decide who's going to transmit when, so that you don't get collision. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to, I don't know, automated vehicles, well, even then, you know, if it's aircraft, then you're going to need tens of microseconds. If it's cars, you will need maybe a microsecond. And then when it comes down to that parking meter, you know, a second's going to be fine, but it needs to be provable.
Mm.
Different markets have different needs, but some of them need very, very accurate. Some of them need very, very resilient because it must not fail.
I guess I'm just interested in the politics of this, because so numeric time, or I suppose saying it is midnight is a human construct. You know, there is no midnight. So therefore, as it's a construct, I suppose there is some debate over who owns time, who owns the most accurate time, who dictates what is and isn't a more accurate form of UTC. So is this sort of control? Is this centralized? You know, can you sort of say, no, well, my UTC is more accurate than yours?
Yes, it's a consortium of scientific institutions, about 70 of them. Such as the National Physical Laboratory here in the UK, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the United States, and so on. And they contribute time and they compare their clocks. They're very, very accurate clocks. I mean, great toys. I wish I could play with some of them. And they check their times against each other and come up with that and a definition of what the time is. And that's an organization called the Bureau des Poids et Mesures in Paris, who actually collate that information and come up with a consensus time. An added complexity is the fact that the Earth, it slows up and speeds down as, snow goes on top of a mountain, it slows down, snow melts, speeds up again, and so on.
Yeah.
Which means that, and also the because of tidal motion.
This is gravity stretching. This is sort of the gravitational dilation.
Yeah, you know, like when a ballerina sticks her arms out, that's equivalent of the snow being at the top of the mountain. And then when she brings them in and spins faster, it's like the snow having melted.
I see. So it's not.
It's like a friction
gravity.
Thing.
It's more essential. It's sort of centrifugal force.
It's a moment of inertia. Yeah, and then
is mental.
Yeah, I think that definitely deserves a little pause for thought.
because of tidal motion, the Earth is actually slowing down. Tomorrow is going to be about 67 nanoseconds longer than today.
That's quite worrying.
When someone says, like, I've really had a long day, it's actually correct.
You work till tomorrow.
Just wait for tomorrow. Yeah.
Tyrannosaurus Rex's day was only 22 and a half hours long.
So, wow. Okay.
Wow. What? Wow. And it's... I mean, maybe you don't know. Is that the same on other planets? It must be.
Well, if they have water, yes. Or perhaps they've got molten interiors. But what this does is it gives you the leap seconds. So leap seconds are, in order for the very, very exact clocks to match the varying motion of the Earth, we have these leap seconds every now and then, every few years. And a leap second is a minute with 61 seconds in it.
That's so cool. Yeah, it's like a leap year.
And they happen every few years. And because nobody has designed a computer that has seconds, but more than 60 seconds in it, from a time delivery perspective, it's a real mess. We're not sure when the next leap second is going to come, but this is going to be a continual problem that we have to deal with.
Wow.
Flipping heck. Yeah, that's absolutely crazy. So I'm immediately, okay, taking this like right the way back to the sort of business case for Hopdrop. What are the customers like when you start explaining these gaps in their understanding to them? Or are they coming to you saying, we've got this problem with time. We've got, you know, one of our competitors is literally running rings around us because they're moving faster than we can. How do you, you know, how can we either speed up the accuracy of our systems improve the accuracy of our systems? Or how does that conversation come about?
It really depends on the market. You know, some people just do it because they have to. Others, such as frequency generation engineers, understand the need very, very well. Mm. When it's a case of, well, these people seem to be beating me in the marketplace, I don't quite understand why, then we have quite a large education process. And largely, our sales is education.
Yeah.
It's not so much about, you know, our product, but why you should need it and how you need to use it.
Yeah, and how much not having it is costing you at the moment.
That's right. And the other thing, of course, is that none of our customers have timekeeping as a day job. They need this done because they want to get on with their day job, which is why, essentially, we think this is a very good opportunity for outsourcing, which is, you know, the basic tenet of our business.
Okay, sure. So, and when a company does engage with you guys, what does that look like? Is there a platform that they are plugging into that is essentially, you know, slowly like checking the time against all of their different systems and infrastructure? Or is there actually kind of a professional services arm to that as well, where you go in and figure out where the gaps are?
We do some of that, but the large part of our business is, I guess, essentially we're half a telecoms company and half a software company.
Mm-hmm.
So the telecoms part is the bit that connects what we call a chain of comparisons back to the standards institutes that we get our time from, feeding that down to wherever a customer needs it. And we work with all the major telecoms companies, like BT, Colt across the road, BSO, and so on, to actually communicate that time. In some particular applications, we actually just use the general internet if the reliability and accuracy is not that great a requirement. So that's the sort of telecom side of it. And then once it arrives at the place where it's needed, the local clock needs to be synchronized. So we then have software which synchronizes those clocks to make sure that the local thing that's producing timing records and synchronizing behavior is actually synchronized to the Standards Institute. And then in applications where some kind of evidence is going to be needed, we then make sure that we've got all of that recorded so that the entire chain of comparisons can be demonstrated and verified.
Wow. Okay. And like you were saying earlier, you know, one of the things here is like, how do you price that? Particularly when you're going across so many different industries as well. It sounds like a really tricky part of the business.
Well, the price level is, it generally relates to the accuracy and the resilience required, and also the scale of what we're trying to synchronize. Because, you know, if to some extent there are economies of scale, if somebody needs to synchronize a very large number of devices, then we can do it more economically than if it's just a few handful of devices.
Okay, so immediately there, my mind went from like a, you know, massive bank where everyone needs their trading terminals to be synchronized to like one mobile device of like a CIA agent or something that has to be, you know. Do you get some requests from some pretty interesting places?
We do.
Can't divulge that information.
Where it is something like a mobile phone or something, it would be for a large number of devices. So sure. It could be achieved at so relatively low cost.
Interesting. It reminds me of the Victorian era, where you had people with sort of, you know, that when accurate timepieces were in sort of short supply, you had people who used to go around to sort of wealthy estates and give them the time so they could reset their inaccurate timepieces, and that would be someone's job, is to go around with the watch.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to think of, you know, we've gone from a place of you know, where accurate time has been really scarce to a point where at the moment it feels like a sort of ubiquitous commodity, to perhaps we're going to the other side of it now, where once again the kind of the time of the accuracy we need it is becoming this kind of scarce and scarcer commodity once more, which I guess is quite sort of just quite interesting to think about as a sort of society, because so much of it depends on time in a way that I don't know if we simply cannot comprehend or don't comprehend it or whatever, but it's, I don't know, it's absolutely fascinating. It's really interesting to think of a resource that we use every day that we don't know we are using it.
You actually just reminded me, I think my great, great, great granduncle used to work at Windsor Castle for Queen Victoria. And he had, his job was to set the time on all of the clocks in Windsor Castle.
So this is just in the blood then, this destiny of time.
What interesting kind of craft to have like in your bloodline.
It is definitely a sort of, there's a great series of sort of semi fantasy novels in here about the timekeepers and this kind of long lineage of people who protected the time, the human time lords. What a great sort of family profession. Do you think, it feels like this is, as we move towards things like the sort of metaverse, you know, we've talked about the Internet of Things, we talked about the ability for, you know, many more pieces of technology to be sort of smarter and therefore for them to be synchronized. I suppose also as if we move into sort of almost like a post-physical society, a sort of a digitized society, you know, where we migrate to the digital realm, this also becomes, you know, increasingly important. And I'm also thinking, when you mentioned the justice of the parking ticket, I can imagine the stakes of justice when we're dealing with that kind of causality in that kind of environment could be sort of life and death. So, you know, do you see yourself sort of, you know, fitting into the metaverse and that sort of next progression of digital life and the digital world, I suppose?
Well, yeah, I mean, life and death, or the way I like to put it, is electrons have consequences. So the virtual world needs to be synchronized because it does things that affect us. In computers will make decisions for us. You know, it might just be whether it's accepting the bet you've just placed, but, you know, if that was a large bet and you won £1 million, but Ladbrokes say, you know, your bet came in late and you think it didn't, you know, you've got quite a big issue there. And the same thing happens in financial markets all the time. So there's lots of reasons why just because it's a virtual world doesn't mean that it isn't going to affect our daily lives. These computers do things that affect us.
And what are the kind of gravest consequences that you see if we, you know, for companies that maybe are at high risk but don't kind of really engage with this as well, as part of their technology strategy?
Well, most of them that do need to are aware of it. I mean, classic one is electricity generation. Mm. You know, put very simply, you know that AC is a sine wave. You know, if you connect together two transformers and those sine waves are not in sync, you've got a pretty big fire on your hands. Some of the industry, and of course, if you do lose electricity, it has a big societal impact. So it's not just the fact that you have, your business has failed. Your impact on society is very great. So there's these kind of needs. Another is frequency generation for radio and TV, because if you can't communicate with people, you can't actually manage an emergency.
Mm.
And then there's other industries. As transportation becomes more and more automated, particularly with the faster devices such as airborne vehicles, the need for accurate timing becomes acute. And awareness of that is only growing because sort of the automation of transport is still in its infancy.
Mm.
And then there's, as we previously discussed, when it will cost you money as a result of not having time, and when an injustice might be done if you don't have time.
It's fascinating. I mean, in a way, what this amounts to is you'll find it through time anchoring something in it almost in the fabric of reality.
Yes, right? That's correct. I mean, we're on the edge of the physical and the virtual. You know, we pump a physical reality into the virtual world. That's what we're achieving.
The physical reality being innately incorruptible. But you know that's such a. I'm not sure I clocked it until right now. That's such a fascinating
not
idea.
Sure you you're clocked taking it.
This. didn't try to do that. Wow, that's yeah, breathtaking. Mm. Do you see that there is a potential for? Do you see that sort of making the statement that or proposing that you have, as it were, a definitive record of time could also become a point of sort of controversy? In the sense that if one person says this is time, this is the definitive sequence of events, the because that is an absolute statement that might benefit one group of people, it feels like the kind of thing another group of people who are disadvantaged might attack.
Indeed, I mean, he who controls the past controls the future, and the only way you can beat that is to have such an overwhelming consensus of what the time is, which is what these scientific institutions achieve, in the same way that you need a majority of Bitcoin miners to have consensus in that world. Only then can you have something that everybody can trust. And then if we all adhere to that, or at least the majority of us adhere to that, then we've got a pretty good consensus of what reality is.
I'm almost going to hand over to Amy to the question that we love to ask in these scenarios. Amy, I'm pretty sure you know what I'm thinking here.
Of course I am. Yes, we always like to ask what comes next. Big surprise. It's always interesting to us to hear what every guest we have thinks about what the future holds. And that can be related to Hop Trough. That can be just a vision that you have for the future. But I'm really interested to hear what you want to see in our future, really.
Well, in a few years' time, there's a couple of areas that I think are very exciting. We are beginning with our Innovate UK grants to actually be investigating these areas, but we'll need to partner with other people to pull it off. The first of those is actually using accurate timing to identify location. Pretty much since Harrison, time has been used to work out where you are. You know, GPS only works because it triangulates according to how the time it took a signal to get to you. So one of the areas I'm very keen to develop is actually producing a time map of the internet so that we can actually, by triangulating time from various time sources that we might have in cloud-based locations, actually get a reasonable idea of when where somebody is. And this is for, because although, you know, your mobile phone will tell you where you are very, very accurately, it's very, very easy to get it to lie. So if you're a server at the other end and you're distributing content, you know, video content or something like that, but you've only got a license to do that in the United States, and there's plenty of people in Canada who will do whatever they can to spoof that.
Yeah,
there in the United States, it's very easy to do unless you do it the way we do it, because you can't spoof the speed of light. Another example like that is the gambling laws in the United States. You are only allowed to gamble online with an organization based in your state, and many states don't permit it at all. Therefore, there's a big incentive to try and pretend you're in a different state.
Yeah.
So I'm very keen to actually introduce that kind of concept in, and we've begun to start doing that now. And the second area is to combine it with blockchain concepts, because right now the idea of, well, more widely than just blockchain, you know, hash ledgers of any sort, because you put in a hash which includes the value from the previous entry, you can actually establish a sequence of events in a way that cannot be faked. However, the way these ledgers work now, there's no real time-related evidence to that. You know, you could actually throw away the whole ledger and just quickly make up a new one. So it doesn't give you complete immutability. Whereas if you do actually put traceable timestamps within the ledger, it starts to become very, very difficult to, in fact, impossible to fake that data after the event. And that then creates essentially a whole new class of data. It's data that you can prove was correct. And that is the other area which I think is the next big thing, if you like.
Okay, who's going to start us off here? Because that was absolutely mind-bending.
I just need to take a moment for the fact that melting snow speeds up the rotation of the planet.
Oh, my God. Yeah, man. So many wicked little sound bites.
Yeah. The fact that
the
dinosaur day was 22 and a half hours long. The dinosaur day was 22 hours. Absolutely amazing.
And also, like, I know we didn't touch on this, but when you think of where the Earth actually was in the galaxy when the dinosaurs were around, we were on the other side of the galaxy. So there was a shorter day, and we were also, like, literally on the other side of the galaxy. That blows my mind, too. But anyway, back to time. Yeah, I was thinking as we chatted that... I was thinking of a book that I read a while ago. Of course, I was thinking of a book I read a while ago, which is actually a sort of young adult book. And it's called The Age of Miracles. And the premise of the book is that there's, for whatever reason, the Earth day keeps getting longer sort of month by month. So they get to this point where the daylight hours in a day are like, you know, you have, I don't know, 17 daylight hours in a day. And then it kind of talks about the impact of what that would have on the planet. So plants would start to die because they're overexposed to the sun, and then food sources go down. And that was kind of what was going through my head. I mean, I know that we're talking about a much shorter time range of days extending, but, you know, billions and billions of years from now, if the days keep continuing to grow, that's obviously going to have massive impact on life on the planet. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah. Absolutely. I thought the I mentioned this on the recording. I only really got there at the end that what they're trying to, what Hochtopf are trying to do is establish, is anchoring events to, as it were, the fabric of reality, right? Like time is what dictates the order of events, and time, because it's connected to space, is, as it were, a sort of, for lack of a better word, a physical quantity. It's not this subjective experience, or obviously it can be, but there is also the procession of time, which has a sort of dimensionality to it and is a physical thing. And by kind of charting that and aligning it to real world events, you can create causality, and you can create therefore responsibility in a sequence and so on. And there are so many layers to what, you know, we were talking about, that actually just did take me that long to really kind of put all that together. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. And what a sort of subtle thing, Quaker, you mentioned this a couple of times, how do you pitch this, how do you talk to customers about what is it, a sort of, you know, on the one hand a really sort of subtle interesting service, on the other hand this quite interesting philosophical sort of physics based concept, and I just loved how all that tied together in one platform, essentially, which is brilliant.
Thank you for listening to this episode of What Comes Next. If you have any questions about today's episode, or if you know of any companies that are doing amazing things in the sphere of technology, then we're always on the lookout for new guests. You can find us at wcn@grantree.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.